Well, I'm very pleased to be the person introducing John Clark today. My name's Pam. I'm with the Toronto Mobilization for Global Justice. And people probably know, but the Toronto Mobilization for Global Justice has been active since the big demonstrations against the WTO in Seattle in 1999. And since then has been building and building the coalition to get the word out about the globalization agenda and taking it on. And just in April, we were able to organize 19 buses and bring over 800 people to Quebec City. And I think one of the fantastic things that the OCAP campaign has done has really put the question of the Harris agenda, the Tory agenda here in Ontario, forefront in people's minds. And I think what Toronto Mobilization for Global Justice has appreciated about it is that it allows us to very concretely link what is happening with the trade deals that are being established around the world and what is happening in our own backyard. Most notably, when Mike Harris took office, and when amongst the first things that he did was cut welfare by 21% and absolutely exacerbated the homeless situation for the poorest of the poor in the province of Ontario. And in the last 6 years, those attacks have been unrelenting, and we see even more attacks are coming down from this provincial government that we saw announced in the May 9th budget and so forth. There's been increased attacks on labor rights and so forth, clawbacks in terms of health and safety provisions and so forth, and it's clear that this government is not going to abandon its agenda until we pick up the fight. And so for that reason, we're very happy to have John Clark with us today to talk about the OCAP campaign. But I'm also very happy to be here today because I just came back from the QP Ontario Convention, and amongst the many resolutions that were discussed, the QP Ontario Division, and I'll just mention this since Bob made an announcement about it, voted overwhelmingly to oppose Plan Colombia. But more importantly, it also voted overwhelmingly to support the OCAP campaign and to send delegates and put resources into the June 15th and 16th meeting. But most significantly of all, I think, is the question that because of the focus on the OCAP campaign, we were able to put the question of a political general strike back on the agenda in this province amongst trade unionists and working people and social justice organizations, and QP Ontario voted to call on the OFL for a general strike against the provincial government before December 2001 to correspond with the activities that will be taking place this fall. No further ado, I'll hand it over to John. Thanks
very, very much. I'm going to talk about the Harris agenda and where I think it fits, and that's true, but I also want to talk very specifically about the campaign of economic disruption that we are, it's got beyond anything, I could say we now, in the sense of OCAP, that OCAP originally sought to initiate that is now really gathering momentum. I'm aware, as I introduce this question, that there is in the room perhaps a varied level of a familiarity with the campaign. There are a number of people I know to be utterly familiar, and I'm going to be going over ground that people have seen covered already. But I want to talk in some detail about the campaign, where it comes from and how it's being delivered. And I hope those people who've heard it before will just bear with me. In terms of the campaign that we're taking up, before I outline exactly what we're trying to do, I think it's important to deal with the context. And the context is precisely the enemy, the Harris government, and the nature of that regime. I made a statement at one meeting, I remember, where I described the sort of the level or layer of petty exploiters who make up so much of the Harris cabinet. You know, the Ernie Eves from the nominee of the Chamber of Commerce of Parry Sound, and Harris himself from North Bay. And I made an observation that it was almost like seeing the Parry Sound Kiwanis Club hold state power. And somebody in the audience said that they thought that was incorrect, that in fact Harris was the embodiment of finance capital. I actually think that both things are true, that finance capital has precisely put in place a regime that is a purveyor of retrogression and backwardness and narrow-mindedness, precisely because it suits its purposes to allow such an attack dog to do the job here in Ontario. And so we've now gone through 6 years of this regime of unbridled social retrogression at every level. And I think as we talk about the Harris regime, those people who have been involved in anti-globalisation struggles can only see one common theme after another crop up. Harris's big slogan was that Ontario is now open for business. And that, of course, is exactly the essence of the regime. The whole question is, as with generally the agenda of global capital, is to remove all barriers to the making of profit and the enrichment of the wealthiest interests at the expense of everybody else. And Harris, of course, couldn't personify that kind of approach to political dealing with any more clarity than he does. He's falling disastrously in the polls, I see, today, and yet, despite the fact that his regime is beginning to lose its gloss, at the same time, there's another article pointing out that corporate donations to the Tory party are double what they are to anybody else. And so clearly we're dealing here with, you know, the regime of choice of Bay Street and Wall Street. And I'm not suggesting for a moment, lest my remarks make anybody think that that's what I'm implying, that in some ways the agenda begins and ends with Harris. It's much broader than that. It's much broader than the Tory regime. But there is no question that in a very real sense that regime is indeed a regime that's been sent in to do a job and is doing it with, I think, an unprecedented level of enthusiasm. So the elements of the regime that is implemented are obvious, and this is where, again, I think the link is very, very clear to the broader agenda of global capital. The question is the removal of anything that stands in the way of enrichment. So all the elements of the network of social provision that used to exist are being systematically dismantled. Those elements of legislation that deal with workers' rights are being systematically undermined. Anything that smacks of environmental protection is not common sense and needs to be removed. Services are to be dismantled, reduced in a way where the most profitable sections will be sold off and privatised, and the rest will be allowed to degrade and erode. And the impact of the agenda has been a startling transformation of the life of this province. And, you know, I mean, one could mention a litany of things. You could mention Walkerton. You could mention in Toronto the incredible situation that OCAP has dealt with in terms of the growth of poverty on a scale that just boggles the mind, the reduction of welfare rates. That led to an explosion in homelessness, so that you now have some 2,000 people a month being evicted in the city of Toronto alone. That's the people who actually go through the legal process of being evicted. For every person who's evicted, there's two or three who give up and leave. An explosion of the number of people on the streets. When we marched on Queen's Park last June 15th, we were aware that the Toronto Disaster Relief Committee had tracked 26 deaths of homeless people in the central part of the city so far that year. And I might add that 15 of those had been active in the work of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. So we took it somewhat personally. And at the same time, and this again I think is a highly common theme, as the agenda is implemented and as they start to remove the elements of social provision, the alternative method of regulating people is used, which is that of physical repression and the billy club. And the elements of that in the Tory agenda are very, very clear. The super jails, the Safe Streets Act, the beefing up of the police, the grooming of Julian Fantino for eventual political office. I mean, all these things are I think, part of the common theme. So in the face of that incredible agenda, the question that has, I think, plagued movements here in Ontario, be it the labour movement, be it social movements of one kind or another, has been how do you in fact challenge an agenda of that kind? Obviously, Harris is not particularly interested in being popular with people who think as we do. I think he's quite reconciled to the fact that the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty doesn't like him very much. So we haven't really thought that that winning the hearts and minds of Mike Harris was exactly a winning proposition or a possibility. Now, there have been, of course, many, many struggles against this government. When I talk in terms of a retreat and in terms of a malaise, I'm not for a moment trying to suggest that there hasn't been many hard-fought attempts and even a few modest victories in terms of taking on the government and its agenda. But still, I think there has been fundamentally at root in the movement's and in the resistance struggles that have taken place, a failure to come to terms with the kind of regime that exists, and as a result, a failure to really seriously grapple with the kind of methods of resistance that could actually make a difference. Harris said, he really does have a sort of for such a dull-witted political thug, he really does have a way with words. And he on one occasion stated that he didn't care if every blade of grass at Queen's Park was trampled down by protesters. They were not his people, and he was going to continue with his agenda. Which, you know, to give the devil his due, if there were others on our side who had the same level of intransigence and determination, we'd all be doing a lot better, quite frankly. I mean, that's how he feels. I mean, he doesn't, for years, he and his people, as they were looking to reshape the Conservative Party and take control of it, they sat around and they talked about what they would like to do to unions and immigrants and what they would like to do to welfare recipients and what they would like to do with people who were worried about the environment and all those things. And finally, they've got the opportunity and they love it. They're having the time of their lives. They're not interested in what we think or what we say. And if we don't like it, that's too bad. We're special interests or whatever. And they proceed with that agenda with a great deal of determination. And so the point that I think comes home is that the concept of protest in that limited sense has become outdated in the face of confronting a government like that of Harris. If you believe that what it is necessary to do is to mobilise a body of opinion to challenge the government, to create the sense that that's a large-scale body of opinion, and make, as it were, a moral case against the government that's hard-hitting and insightful, that will somehow get the government to respond, that has really run its course. It's simply not going to happen. They simply don't care. And I can't emphasise that point enough, because that old method of thinking still does dominate people's practice to a huge degree. I mean, I've used this example many times, but it just grates on me, and I have to say it again today. I don't know how many people at rallies against the Harris government, somewhere in their remarks, use these words: "I hope you're listening, Mike Harris." And it seems to me that's symptomatic of something very, very important, that the time has come to recognise that he's not listening. The time has come to recognise that you're not going to be able to make a case that's based on reason and compassion and moral outrage and all these things and get the government to respond. And so the question becomes one of moving beyond, I use the terms a little arbitrarily, I suppose, but moving beyond protest and moving into resistance. And that seems to be the enormously important leap that has in part been made, but needs to be made very emphatically and very, very clearly. So in terms of OCAP's contribution to developing this kind of thinking and this kind of method of resistance, we, of course, are an organisation, and I don't for one moment want to exaggerate our power and our strength. We're a largely Toronto-based organisation with a constituency of people made up largely of poor and homeless people. We're not the labour movement. We don't have huge resources. But what we have tried to do is think through how we can actually struggle effectively. And that's dominated our thinking. It's plagued our thinking. Because, you know, we've watched a lot of people die amongst the homeless. I got home last night, and there's a message from a social worker on the phone just pointing out that this man, Pete, who comes into the Parkdale office every day with a little dog, is dead, and that his funeral is going to be next week. And we get those kinds of calls all the time from people that we know well, people that we work with all the time. I mean, Pete was an extraordinary man. He came from Cape Croker. He was a member of the Ojibwe Nation. One day he brought in a tape recording that his father had made talking about the life of the Ojibwe Nation, and a man of great understanding and a man of great decency. And his life is just crushed and snuffed out. So it isn't just a question of being some kind of silly ideologue here. What this agenda is doing to people is killing people and wrecking their lives and destroying their lives and bringing misery into people's lives. And that's why when we talk about trying to find the ways to resist that count for something and mean something, to us it's an enormously important proposition. And so we've, of course, all the time deal with people coming into our offices who are being denied assistance, who are facing eviction. Those kinds of things have prompted us to try and think through how we can actually fight in a way that makes a difference. And some of the initial ways in which we began at the case-by-case level was to start to mobilise to ensure that people didn't get evicted, that people got their welfare, that families didn't get deported from the country and those kinds of things. And we developed a method of work that we called direct action casework. And rather than go to the tribunals and all the rituals that they set up to make you ineffective, we instead used methods of just mobilising, to go down and take over welfare offices, to take over immigration enforcement centres, to do the things that would actually gum up their bureaucracies and, you know, scare the shit out of them, and actually do things that had a real impact. And out of that method, we realised that we weren't strong enough to actually prevent a lot of the attacks happening, but we tried to find ways to impede and harass the agenda that Harris was implementing, so that we would try to resist the closings of shelters, people being put on the streets, by doing things like, on one occasion, we took over the doctor's hospital, which was supposed to become a shelter for homeless people, but they were stalling on it because of local business and upscale resident opposition, and all those kinds of things. When workfare programs were implemented, we didn't bother going to Queen's Park and holding a demonstration at Queen's Park that they wouldn't listen to. What we did instead was started going after the employers and agencies that were starting to implement workfare so that we could actually impede the implementation of the agenda. And that proved to be very effective. In fact, the Commissioner of Social Services told a visiting academic that OCAP had created a climate of intimidation around the implementation of workfare. And so, you know, those kinds of things at every point made us sort of think, how can we move forward? And then on June 15th of last year, there was the march to Queen's Park, at which we tried to sort of issue a call to the broader movement about what it meant to fight to win. And we marched on the legislature, and I'm sure people are pretty familiar with the resulting situation that occurred, where the police came in. I don't want to belabor the point about June 15th, but I just simply wanted to make the point that on June 15th, we were attacked very, very seriously and denounced in the media and all the rest of it. And what it actually did was strengthened us to a huge degree, more support than we'd ever seen before. So we drew from that the conclusion that we needed to move forward. We needed to try and do something that would actually elevate the level of resistance against Harris. And so we came up with our plan for economic disruption. And basically the notion of economic disruption is to mobilise people in communities in such a way that you go beyond protesting the government and you start doing the very thing that is attacking them in their most fundamentally weak spot, which is the cash register. That's the thing that we think can actually create a situation where, if it were elevated to a sufficiently broad level, you could have a situation where, in fact, this government became a cost-ineffective proposition as far as its corporate backers were concerned. If the amount of disruption and economic pain involved in implementing their agenda becomes sufficiently painful to them, you've generated a situation where you can call into question the actual implementation of that agenda. And so we started to travel the province a number of months ago, going to communities everywhere throughout Ontario, to First Nations communities, to towns and cities, and we started floating this idea with people. And people started to set up local committees, organisations started to debate and discuss the issue, and there was huge support for it. So that we now have First Nations communities discussing putting up road blockades and other such activities, which of course they have huge experience in doing. We have communities everywhere talking about how they can implement economic disruption. Some of them potentially hugely financially costly, but some of them politically important as well. For example, First Nations people around North Bay talking about closing down the golf courses in the city. Those communities that exist along the corridor from Montreal to Windsor know that they have there the NAFTA superhighway, bringing billions of dollars in just-in-time inventory back and forward across those border crossings. And it's the same down at Buffalo, Fort Erie, and those kinds of tactics. So those are the kinds of things that we're proposing. And now, as more and more trade union support starts to come in, for the first time what's seriously being posed is the political strike weapon also being used, which takes things to a whole new level of resistance. So it's clear that this is an idea that is, as the term goes, resonating. We decided that October the 16th will be the starting date for the campaign. The actual date is quite arbitrary, but the timing for us is important. We wanted to leave as much preparation time as possible, but at the same time, we wanted to be able to engage in a wave of activity across the province that wouldn't shut Northern Ontario out. If we go later than that, we've got real problems in terms of the weather closing in. So on October the 16th, what we're looking to do, and we're going to be discussing this with OCAP allies and other organisations, and we'll want the broadest possible endorsement, is an action in the financial district in the centre of Toronto to kick things off. Now, I'm familiar with, of course, the question of November 9th. and we hope that the two things can very much complement each other. We hope that we can work to give them a double blow in terms of the mobilisation. But we feel that we must begin with a powerful and a strong action in Toronto itself. And so on that basis, we're certainly going to ask Mob for Glob to throw as much support as you possibly can for this action on the 16th. I'll end there, actually, but I just wanted to finish by pointing out one thing in terms of the practical situation ahead. We're having an assembly on the 15th and 16th of the month. It's going to be enormously important. People are signing up to come from everywhere. The Saturday portion is going to be for delegates from organisations, but we're going to begin the thing on the Friday night. And the Toronto District School Board has actually given us a situation that is, in one sense, problematic, but in another sense, perhaps rather fitting in an ironic sense, in that they suddenly informed us, months after we initially took the space and began the preparations and put out the leaflets, they suddenly told us that we can't have it because they're concerned about property damage to the school, which is completely absurd. But at this point, they're telling us we can't have the meeting space. So the situation is that our initial assembly, we're having to actually fight for the location. And it's sort of perhaps nice that, you know, the Toronto Convention Centre or the Sheraton Centre isn't where this is going to happen. It's actually going to be a struggle to actually even get a school auditorium to hold the thing. So on the 13th, there's going to be presentations and deputations to the Toronto District School Board, and we hope you'll come down and support that as well. I'll end there, but just to to emphasise that as far as we are concerned, what we are seeking to do is, and we don't know at this point all of the impacts that we're going to have, but we believe that what is going to happen beginning October the 16th is going to be a contribution, a fundamental contribution to changing the nature of resistance here in Ontario. And if that takes place, the implications across Canada and even internationally are enormously important. So we're looking to strike a blow. We hope you'll join us in striking that blow, and we hope we'll make it a really decisive one. Thank you very much.
A lot of the anti-globalization activists have organized using affinity groups and in various sort of decentralized ways and have employed a lot of direct action tactics. And I'm wondering what contribution you think anti-globalization activists specifically could make to the OCAP campaign.
Yeah, that's a very important question. I think I took a little longer in my initial speech than I intended to, and it was a point I'm glad to return to it anyway. It needs to be addressed. I think the affinity group model offers an incredible opportunity in terms of developing this model of economic disruption for a number of reasons. We are not going to deliberately, we're not seeking to establish some provincial council that oversees economic disruption in Ontario. First of all, we don't think that's an effective way of doing it. And secondly, from a security point of view, I don't know if I would necessarily want to be on that committee. I don't know about anybody else. The point about it is that what will, of course, happen is there will be a number of seriously major planned out events that people are going to work on. And there'll be a level of coordination mainly around questions of timing. Because, as I said, we're not primarily looking to have a model of a day of action. We're looking to have a wave of activity that passes through the province and back and forth reverberates. But when it comes to the actual notion of affinity group organising, I think in terms of how this could be implemented, it has incredible possibilities. Precisely because we're looking to put together something that they can't solve with the riot squad. Right? One of the things we were talking about doing was actually, in addition to the actual planned events, was to issue a general call for economic disruption. So that, for example, in Kingston, the people that worked on the caravan there, have come up with the notion that what they're going to do is issue the general call in Kingston and have this sort of prize system where they give out wrenches to people who do the best economic disruption activity. And we were actually thinking in terms of doing it in such a way that you issue the call, in addition to the planned events, you issue the call, you give out in a local area the radio station or the TV station, and you ask people to do what they do and then phone in and say what they've done. And it doesn't even have to be groups, it could be individuals, you know. So you start to get people say, I phoned in sick, my car broke down, ha ha. You know, I mean, all the things that could be done that actually start to give people an opportunity to take initiatives. Now, if people in affinity groups decide, even as part of large events or just individually, to think of ways in which they can economically disrupt and implement those things, I think it has incredible possibilities, because it starts to be something that enters people's popular thinking and starts to enter into areas of the community that we hadn't really even envisaged we would have contact with before. So I think that's an enormously important part of it. The question was asked about trade union involvement. I don't by any means have a comprehensive list. I work mainly out of the West End office of OCAP, and the central list is being developed in the other office. But I'm aware, just by my quick reckoning here, really importantly in terms of the CAW, several locals have signed on, but the CAW flying squads, if anybody's familiar with that formation. That's enormously important, and they've done it. We've got now, to my knowledge, two Labour councils that have formally signed on, North Bay and Stratford. We're going before the Toronto Labour Council on the 7th of the month. But a couple of other ones have indicated to us this week that they'll be sending observers to the event, Hamilton and London. As well as that, within the teachers, we have the Elementary Teachers Federation of Hamilton Wentworth, which is playing a really active role in the Hamilton Committee and has signed on enthusiastically. Substitute teachers in Toronto, as well as District 12 of OSSTF. We have a whole series of QP locals, 3903, 1281, 3902, as well as QP Ontario, as was mentioned. We have two locals within the steelworkers, one in North Toronto, one down in Stratford. We have a CEP local that just signed on in the last couple of days. I just saw it. I'm not quite sure what part of the province they're in. In terms of the OFL itself, actually, Wayne Samuelson has suggested to us that we should meet up next week and talk, so we'll be seeing where that goes. And outside and beyond, I mean, the fact that I'm here and that Mobilisation for Global Justice has signed on, a number of other groups of people involved in anti-globalisation struggles have signed on, but also within First Nations. I mean, there are all kinds of different social organisations that have signed on, but we now have been to over 30 First Nations communities, and with people organising right across, you know, in terms of the North Shore and Lake Superior, looks really powerful. We even had a couple of fly-in reserves, people call us, who got posters and asked what they could do in their communities. So, I mean, it really is starting to sweep through the province. And I think that's about it.
Yes?
What are you doing about high school students?
Oh, God, yeah, I'm sorry. The question's asked high school students. Several of our people have been working high schools. Toronto, Mississauga, Stratford, Sudbury, to my knowledge, high school students talking around walkouts. And actually, a number of them have organised in such a way that when Tim Groves, who's our organiser in terms of high school stuff, just out of high school himself, he met with a number of people from different schools here in Toronto and proposed the idea of walkouts, and they said, well, you know, we do them quite a bit, but the real question we'd like to know is what you want us to do when we get out. So high schools offer an enormous, I think, reservoir in terms of this stuff. First of all, with trying to be concrete, in terms of what economic disruption could look like, I actually tried as best I could to paint a picture of the kind of activity that people could engage in. But if you want to talk about a symbol, I can think of one. And that was the last time I was down in Windsor. I saw what the NAFTA highway now looks like. A line of trucks both ways coming across the Ambassador Bridge that was unbelievable in terms of how long it was. The amount of money coming across is unbelievable. Remember, it's just-in-time inventory now that we're talking about. Because in order to maximise profit, one of the things that they have done is taken the supply of inventory off of the rails, put it onto the highways in the form of trucks, and reduced the amount of inventory that they keep on hand. So that the Ford Motor Company now is now working to a situation where they will have 12 hours worth of inventory in the plant and 8 hours on the highway. That's what they're talking about. Now, the possibilities in terms of, and I'm not just talking about the Ambassador Bridge, so, you know, if there's any supply of information to the cops here, you know, I don't think you're going to solve it by taking the riot squad down to the Ambassador Bridge. But people are going to organise in communities in Windsor, in communities everywhere, and actually interfere fundamentally with the NAFTA superhighway. I can't think of a more powerful symbol of economic disruption, with the sole exception of the labour movement actually organising a province-wide shutdown, which we will agitate for and we will work for and we will work towards. But if at this point, if it should prove the case that only some level of trade union strike activity is thrown into this, even organising at purely the community level, we could cost them billions of dollars and we could hurt them very, very fundamentally. And in terms of the lessons of European struggles, I think, people have already mentioned France, but I think of the struggle against the Berlusconi government, which may have to now be repeated, in 1994, and the kind of strike activity that took place there. And I think it was enormous lessons to be learned from that struggle, both in terms of the way in which community activity and trade union strike activity linked up, so that you had high school walkouts, for example, as part of the anti-Berlusconi struggle. And it was very instructive the way that government and its plans to dismantle the pension system, which was the linchpin of the social provision system within Italy, was defeated. When the unions first announced that they intended to launch a general strike, Berlusconi, he's another one of these characters who likes to go with flourish. He made this statement that not one, not 10, not 1,000 general strikes will make me change my mind. But within a short space of time, the big financial newspapers of the leading sections of the Italian European bourgeoisie were actually in their editorials saying, you know, Berlusconi has blown it, he's a bungler, he's got to go, we've got to get rid of him. You know, I mean, it really did create a situation where his regime became a liability. And if anybody thinks there wouldn't come a point at which Bay Street wouldn't suddenly disown Mike Harris, that's really a real possibility. Now, I'm not saying we don't want to set up a campaign in which we judge success or failure according to whether the Harris government is still there after we've been able to organise our first wave of activity. If all this is able to achieve, and it won't be a small thing, is to redefine the nature of the struggle and prepare for an even greater round of struggle after that, that will be a magnificent achievement. When we say the retreat is over, we pick that slogan very, very carefully. I think that's about it, except for the question was asked, and I must respond fairly to the question of electoral involvement. And the answer is no, we don't really have such plans. I wouldn't want to really bog down on major disagreements over the question, but I don't think that the enthusiasm for door-knocking for certainly not the Liberals and maybe even the NDP within OCAP is going to be that enormous, to be quite honest. But that's the honest answer. And I think those are questions that the movement is going to have to grapple with and discuss. And I wouldn't want to make the economic disruption campaign in any way contingent on those discussions at that point.
Okay. Well, there's a whole series of things that some of them, I think, stood by themselves as comments. But a couple of points I perhaps should respond to. First of all, the question was asked about Acquasossany. I wasn't personally involved in the situation at Acquasossany, but some OCAP people were, so I can offer a bit of light on it. A plan emerged within the community, following discussions with a couple of our organisers, to try to create a situation where the bridge was opened up. But as the campaign got underway, there was a huge job done to, in every possible way, discredit it, involving state authorities on both sides of the border, to the point that a flyer actually went around with our name on it in the community saying, calling all criminals, we invite you to come to Acquasossany. So, I mean, there was a huge, disinformation job that was done. Now, in terms of whether there was support in the community, we know there was very large-scale support. The plan that was devised to actually open the bridge was not successful in the way that it had been hoped. But in terms of the amount of support that actually came in and the people in the community who were involved in the activity, that's in fact one of the most important legacies of the thing, that there's been a real upsurge in terms of involvement in Acquasossany itself. Now, in terms of the traditional leadership, there was a statement issued purporting to cover all warrior societies that was actually issued by some people who were Senecas living off the reserve. And our information is that the OPP was actually involved in the meeting at which that statement was put together. In terms of traditional leadership generally, we had considerable support. And in fact, the Bear Clan at Acquasossany met for the first time shortly afterwards for a considerable period of time, and it was a huge turnout, and there really is, enormous enthusiasm within Acquasossany itself. There is no question that the Indian Act leadership was hostile from the word go, and still is. But, I mean, Acquasossany, that leadership was established in 1899 by sending in a detachment of the RCMP, shooting the head traditional chief and imprisoning the rest. Mike Mitchell, who is the elected chief in Acquasossany, in a community of 7,000 people in the last election, got 180 votes.
So, I mean, I'm afraid if you're going to organise in First Nations communities, that there will be people within the Indian Act leadership who will be avowedly hostile from the word go. It's part of the reality. And perhaps when we get to discussing walkouts in plants, we may come up against some of the same problems, you know. I mean, that's part of the reality of what we're doing. So we're very confident that there is a real strong base in that community that's growing. Some of the other questions that were asked, I suppose a couple came up around the mood that's there, and we just think there's an incredible opportunity now that is presented by exactly the mood that's starting to galvanise here in Ontario and beyond. And, I mean, we have the strongest possible sense. You know, when you start to do a lot of this work, you once in a while have a feeling that things are really starting to come together, and I don't know about everybody else, but I've certainly got that feeling now. I don't doubt that there's going to be a real mood to take on Mike Harris and that we're really going to feed something. And I equally don't doubt that Quebec City was a real watershed in terms of a readiness not just to be outraged at what capitalism is doing, but to actually challenge it very, very concretely and directly. The question came up around people's safety, and I think it's a very, very important consideration, and the point that Denise made is well taken, that we want to look for a whole series of ways in which people can be involved at whatever level they feel. I think we've got to talk about how events can be organised to support this, where people who want to bring small children or just their personal outlook on things makes for them to want to be very physically safe, and I think that's enormously important. At the same time, I do think we have to recognise that if we're going to fight global capital, that is not going to be without escalation, it's not going to be without the taking of risks, and it's not going to be without people putting themselves in frontline situations. That is part of the reality too. So, I think we want to build a movement in which there's a lot of space for people to act as they feel appropriate. I think we want to ensure, absolutely make every effort we can to ensure that situations don't arise where people go into things they weren't expecting and they weren't ready for. That's fundamental. And to some degree, I'd say a great deal about June 15th is its great success, but I must say we had never anticipated the kind of attack that they would launch on us, the actual clearing of the grounds in the way that it occurred. We discussed it as a remote possibility, but we didn't think they would be so insane as to actually try to sweep through the legislature in the way they did. And so our notion of a front line and a rear where people would be safe came unglued, and that's the reality, and we feel very bad about that. We've learned a lot from that experience, and I don't think we'd make that mistake again. So I think your concern is a really vital one that needs to be taken very seriously. Then there were a couple of questions, and the first one was around central tech. We certainly have, I think, every right to say that we had booked this meeting space well in advance, that it was given to us fairly and squarely. We went through all the proper channels, and I think we have a right to make an issue about it. I think it's fair to say as well that on June 15th we plan a meeting. This is not the economic disruption campaign, this is a meeting. And the fact that it's on the first anniversary of the June 15th event makes it a particularly important meeting. We chose the date very, very carefully. In terms of what we actually will plan to do that night, we do plan to have a meeting. Unfortunately, I mean, the reality is, I mean, Now Magazine's here, for example. So it puts me in a bit of a difficult situation in terms of actually mapping out, concrete positions. If we say that we're going to march there and we're going to demand to take the school, well, then that sets a certain tone. On the other hand, if we say we're going to march there and if they turn us away, we won't make an issue of it, then we're virtually telling the school board they've got nothing to worry about. So I'm really not in a position to say much in detail, except to say that your point is an excellent one, and it's well taken, and I'll be very happy to tell you outside what we plan to do. The broader question comes up with the media, and I'm sorry, the first time David raised it, I missed the point. I think it's a very important one. And that is to say that June 15th was to us, and the Safe Park that we did in Allen Gardens the year before was on a slightly smaller scale, illustrative of the same thing. I mean, the media went after us incredibly at both of those events. I mean, the Safe Park was the first time we'd seen the kind of what in the 1930s they used to refer to as yellow journalism, where you actually got, I mean, things being said that were just incredible. I mean, when we had the Safe Park, the Globe and Mail was talking about us using the greenhouse in Allen Gardens as a latrine, which, I mean, was just like utter, I mean, this kind of just wild fabrication where and the venom, and June 15th was worse. I mean, there was just, but you know what? The reality is it totally backfired on them. I mean, the degree to which people supported us, and they saw the media attack as an absolutely central part of the notion that we were being beaten up on by vested interests. It wasn't just sort of people in the activist world. The 2 months that after they arrested me, where a whole pile of people got arrested, but for 2 months I wasn't able to go into my actual job because I was banned from associating with anybody in OCAP until we got that overturned in the higher courts. And for those 2 months I had a bit of time on my hands, and I was going around the streets a lot, and it was incredible, the support. I mean, I was getting like 10, 20 people a day coming up to me and shaking my hand. Yeah, man on the subway gave $50 to OCAP. Took my little boy over to Toronto Islands, and the captain of the tour boat came down to congratulate me. And I mean, it was just, it was phenomenal. It was just unbelievable, the support that was there. So, I mean, they sometimes can overplay their hand. Now, in terms of the economic disruption campaign, well, look, if I was a billionaire and I owned a newspaper or a TV station, I'd certainly say hostile things about the economic disruption campaign, and it won't be any different. You know, there's no way on this earth that rabid hatred in the media is a given for this campaign. You know, and we can strategize about our own communication systems, we can strategize about how we're going to deal with it, what we're going to say to them, how we're going to conduct ourselves, who will and who won't be spokespersons, when we will and won't speak to them. But, you know, those are all very important considerations. But anybody who thinks that we can organize this in such a way, that was one of the problems with the Days of Action. You know, you can't shut down a city and have the big business media love you. And so you try and play it both ways. You become thoroughly paralyzed and compromised. And I think that's the situation. There isn't going to be any good press on this one, I don't think. And to the extent that we can get some, great. But, you know, it's not the central question. The central question is to do what works, be effective, be strong, and to grow as a movement. That to us is what's important. So that's sort of perhaps just by way of wrapping up. All I can say is that I hope people will strongly, as individuals, Mob for Glob itself is supporting the campaign. I hope people as individuals will work on this in every way they can. Come out on the 13th to the Toronto District School Board at 6:30 at McCall and College, and generally be involved in this campaign in every way you can. And please, on the Friday night, come out and join the assembly. And we're going to do some things that are going to kind of shake them up and change the rules of the game. It's going to be important. Thank you.
I want to thank John for his time today. I also want to let people know that it has been mentioned many times, Mobilization for Global Justice is actively organizing for the OCAP campaign. And what we're planning to do is still very much being discussed within the organization. I'd really encourage you to come out to our meeting. And again, thanks very much to John for your time and for all the fantastic work that OCAP is doing.